this is Angela Kenrick from Team 2, coming to you from Wealthview House with a very special guest. I have been researching the life of Wealthview House's founder, Mr. John Wealthview, for many years, and on the occasion of his 200th birthday, I'm finally producing his biography. In anticipation of this, we have secured a world exclusive, an interview with the man himself. Here he is in the studio, smartly dressed in a black suit with black waistcoat, white shirt with turned down collar over a black cravat which is tied into a bow tie. He sports a very interesting neck beard, shaved below the chin, which to some of today's hipster chaps would be very impressed with. He has light brown hair, swept back and curling under his ears. The interview will be in three parts. So, here to tell us about his early life, Mr. John Wealthview. Hello, sir.
Hello, Angela and listeners. You must call me John.
Thank you, John, and welcome to Wealthview House.
Oh, it's an honour. Thank you. Oh, Wealthview House. I'm humbled by the name change, and it's still going after all this time. Although, sad that it's still necessary.
Shall we start at the beginning? Are you a local lad?
Well, I was born in Hyde, but in 1822, Hyde was in the parish of Stockport, and we had family living in Stockport town centre, Chestergate. We moved around a bit until the early 1830s, when we settled in Heaton Norris, Old Road. There were several cotton mills in walking distance, but much more pleasant than industrial Manchester.
Was it a happy childhood?
It was hard, but we were a close family, very close, with 11 of us in a small house at one time. My father was a cotton weaver, then overlooker. He worked his way up too, so we were better off than other families, but there were many ups and downs. Sometimes we had to go without feet covering or wear clogs. I learnt the importance of frugality and saving very early on, and of fighting diligently for a good education.
You had a strong connection to Stockport's famous Sunday school.
Oh, yes indeed. As I was working in Reed's Mill, Coronation Street in Reddish, from the age of 11, Sunday school classes were vitally important. Neither of my parents could write. I had to register my 8-year-old brother's death for them. The Mechanics Institute was also a great help to me.
Oh, that was similar to a technical college, a night school.
Yes, but they also had a library and reading room, which I made good use of. Before these things were publicly available, of course, as they now are.
I have here a card, the size of a postcard, which is an award from the Mechanics Institution from 1846 for your participation in the discussion class. It's obviously much treasured.
Oh, yes. I was particularly interested in debate and discussion. There were troubled times, the 1840s, and social reform interested me greatly. The ability of a working man to have his voice heard or even effect change to help people inspired me.
You were also able to make some useful contacts by mixing in these circles.
Yes, I had the opportunity to learn from some very successful men. Cephas Howard was a keen supporter of the Sunday school, and he took me on as bookkeeper at his Marsland Street mill on Portwood, where I was able to get a much fuller picture of how a cotton mill ran.
So how did you actually start out in the business?
Oh, thrift and saving. Yeah, well, I purchased a few doubling frames in Newbridge Lane Mill. You could hire space. Rooms and turning, as it was called. You paid for the room and access to the power supply in the form of a turning pole on the ceiling. A belt from your machinery was attached to the pole, which powered the machine.
Could you explain what doubling is, please?
Oh, of course. Well, doubling is twisting two or more threads together to produce a stronger thread for sewing or embroidery thread. By starting in this way, I didn't have to worry about costly carding and spinning machinery. I just specialised in the doubling process, which hardly anyone was doing in Stockport at the time.
And was it a success?
Oh, eventually, yes. But not without a lot of hard work. 12 or 13-hour days and support from my family, who were all experienced cotton operatives. By August 1855, I was able to purchase my own mill, Spring Mount on Brinksway.
A significant milestone at age 33. I imagine your family were really proud of you.
Well, my family was a little larger by then. I had married Mary in June 1854, and we welcomed our first child, Louisa, just 12 days before the auction.
So you were creating a legacy in more ways than one. Where were you living at this time?
Well, Mary and I had moved to a large house on Greek Street. It was large compared to what we had both grown up in. We moved there from the smoke. The smoke from the station was affecting our health, and the noise and activity from the new armoury became a little irritating. We moved to Beecham Street, not far from here. I notice it's been demolished now, though.
So, by 1859, you had a growing family and thriving business. You took on another challenge.
Yes, I was elected councillor for the Edgeley Ward. It was a chance to have a say in local matters, and as a Liberal and supporter of reform, I was able to represent the working man. I was re-elected in 1862 for 3 more years.
This covered the period of the cotton famine then, when the American ports were blockaded. A time of terrible distress in the cotton districts.
Oh, it was. A terrible time. Mills were closed altogether and working short time for a few years. The government was slow to act, providing relief, and many people were starving. As a small mill owner, it was more difficult than for larger businesses. Well, to try to assist by 56 employees while still paying rent and rates and keeping the business viable for the future. Of course, our minor hardships were as nothing compared to many of the operatives. Most of us understood the cause was just, though. We knew if our sacrifices could help to break the chain of the slave, establishing freedom for all, then we were right to resist cries for intervention to stop the blockade.
Is there an irony in a cotton manufacturer calling for an end to slavery?
Well, personally, I don't think so. As an active member of the Union and Emancipation Society, I and many abolitionists called directly on Abraham Lincoln to enact an amendment to their constitution to abolish slavery. He even replied to the people of Manchester, acknowledging our support and suffering.
Now, during this time, the Stockport Advertiser reported, rather cynically, on a fire at Spring Mount, a case of spontaneous combustion.
Yes, well, the Advertiser reporters weren't known for their support of us Liberals. Cotton waste is highly flammable in dry storerooms, and my insurance company had no issue with it. Thankfully, the local cottagers spotted the flames and were able to prevent fire spreading very far before the engines arrived. The on-site reservoir proved its worth.
Although the early 60s, though, also saw tragedy for your family.
Yes, we lost 3 little ones. Laura lived only for a few months in 1860. Arthur started with TB the following year, and then Herbert, just after his first birthday, began having convulsions. He died of inflammation to the brain a few days later. It seemed each year would bring sadness, and so in 63 Arthur succumbed to the TB, poor little fellow. He was only 7. But, well, it wasn't all sadness, though. We welcomed baby Emmy, Emmeline, in July 63, and a son Harold in 66. We'd moved to Sparth Mount by then. The atmosphere there was much healthier.
That's Sparth Mount in Heaton Norris?
Yes, but quite unlike my childhood home. A large house of grounds. We managed to find a coachman who could do the garden as well.
The start of happier times.
Oh, indeed. The cotton famine ended, and George, that's my younger brother, he came in with me and we brought Brinksway Mills over the road from Spring Mount. It was a huge complex. We started spinning our own cotton, but it also came with 38 cottages for the operatives, so we became landlords as well.
And there was a very important initiative in 1866. Why we're here now, in fact. Can you tell us how it all started?
Yes, well, great deal of credit goes to Mary, my wife. Our daughter Louie, that's Louisa, became blind when she was 3 years old in 1858. And as she grew, we were obviously in a more privileged position to care for and encourage her, but we wondered how other people managed. With my work on the council, I saw that there was very little support in Stockport. And in January 1866, I think it was, we ordered a room at the Sunday school and we invited what we imagined to be around a dozen to 20 blind people in the town to a free tea party. We were amazed when 64 arrived with companions. Well, there was a wide age range, between 6 and 78. There were over 150 people there altogether, I think. Only 4 or 5 were born blind. The remainder, at different ages, were made so by various accidents. Smallpox, of course, as well, and principally inflammation. Mrs. Sidebottom and Howard provided gifts, an orange and a bun, and a shilling for each blind person, and there was a lot of singing. Pleasant evening, which lasted until around 10 o'clock.
And this encouraged you to do more.
Oh, of course. Well, we established regular meetings at the Mechanics Institute from October 66, which was soon attended by 40 to 50 people. The younger people in particular showed an aptitude for learning to read. Volunteers came forward and we received a lot of support, donations of materials, clothes and money. We soon realised we needed to establish something larger and more permanent.
That's a really inspiring start, John. And I'm sorry, but we're out of time for this first part. Thank you so much for talking to us so openly. We look forward to hearing you again next time.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Until next time.
Goodbye.